From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Spain's leading filmmaker, Pedro Almodóvar. He's best known in America for his comedies Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown and Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, whose X rating was challenged in the courts. His new film, High Heels, is a gender-bending comic melodrama. Also today, we examine Vice President Dan Quayle's Council on Competitiveness. It's a group that's working to streamline federal regulations that hurt business. Critics say it's operating like a shadow government, sabotaging environmental and health safeguards. Rock historian Ed Ward recommends the best box sets of the year. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Warren Beatty's new film, Bugsy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A senior administration official said today that President Bush has decided to recognize Russia as the successor to the Soviet Union. The official said that the president will announce direct diplomatic relations with Russia on Thursday. The president spoke with Russian President Boris Yeltsin on the telephone today and congratulated him on the formation of the 11-republic Commonwealth of Independent States over the weekend. The official said that the United States will accord formal recognition to other former republics soon, but that only Russia will receive the status that was enjoyed by the Soviet Union. There's been fighting all day in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Opposition forces in Tbilisi, the Georgian capital, have surrounded the Republic's parliament. They've attempted to storm the building several times in an effort to force the resignation of the Republic's president. NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
The rebel militiamen in Georgia are experienced soldiers, National Guardsmen, who turned against President Viad Gamsakhurdia last August. They have heavy weapons at their disposal, and they are using them. A spokesperson at the parliament reached by telephone today said the building was seriously damaged by artillery and mortar fire. Gamsakhurdia himself admitted in an interview with the BBC today that he is trapped in the parliament and cannot get out. He insisted, however, he will not surrender. Gamsakhurdia's critics say he's turned into a dictator since he was elected president of Georgia last May. The rebel forces now surrounding the parliament say they won't give up their siege until Gamsakhurdia agrees to leave office. The fighting between the rebel forces and troops loyal to Gamsakhurdia paused this afternoon, but there's no report of negotiations taking place between the two sides. I'm Tom Jelton in Moscow.
The United Nations has confirmed that a body found in Beirut yesterday is that of former American hostage Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins, who was abducted in February of 1988. At the time of his abduction, Higgins was serving with the UN in southern Lebanon. Details from Gerald Butt in Nicosia.
Lebanese police found a body in the streets of Beirut just before dawn following an anonymous telephone call, but it was several hours before formal identification was made by Gian Domenico Pico, the UN envoy who's been conducting negotiations for the release of hostages and prisoners in the Middle East. Colonel Higgins' body was later handed over to US embassy officials. The Marine colonel was kidnapped nearly 4 years ago when, in July 1989, the Israelis abducted a Shiite cleric from southern Lebanon. Higgins' kidnappers claimed to have killed their captive in retaliation. But UN sources believe he was tortured and murdered at an earlier date. The return of Higgins' body marks a further success for the efforts of UN hostage envoy Pico, who's also trying to secure the return of the bodies of Israelis missing in Lebanon. For National Public Radio, this is Gerald Butt in Nicosia.
The Dow Industrials gained more than 88 points today. This is NPR News. Texas Governor Ann Richards said today that she'd ask federal officials to declare disasters in two Texas counties that were swept by floods that killed at least 13 people. Richards said she'd seek disaster assistance for Bastrop and Travis counties, which suffered heavy flooding after 6 days of rain. The skies were reported to be clear today, but weather forecasters predicted more rain on Christmas Day. In the Cambodian capital, Phnom Penh, the government has closed down schools and universities as it tries to regain control following weekend violence that left at least 3 people dead. The disturbances erupted when students protested growing corruption in Cambodia. Catherine McGraw reports from Bangkok.
The government hasn't said how long the educational institutions will be closed, but it's believed they won't reopen before the 7th of January. That's when Cambodians celebrate their national day and the overthrow of the Khmer Rouge. The peace process in Cambodia remains uncertain. the Supreme National Council that groups the four warring factions together under the UN-sponsored agreement, still hasn't held its first meeting in Phnom Penh. Earlier this month, Khmer Rouge leader Khieu Samphan arrived in the Cambodian capital, only to be driven out hours later after an angry mob tried to lynch him. Now the Khmer Rouge say it's not safe for them to return. However, while they stay away, the peace process remains in limbo. For National Public Radio, I'm Catherine McGrath in Bangkok.
Americans' personal income dropped last month just as colder weather pushed up their expenses. The Commerce Department reported today that personal incomes fell by 0.1% in November, the first drop since July. At the same time, consumer spending was up by 0.7%, more than many economists had been expecting. Analysts said that much of that increase came in the form of increased utility costs, such as gas and electricity, rather than growth in voluntary spending. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You might think of Spain as having a very macho culture, but Spain's most popular filmmaker creates characters who subvert gender roles and live outside of conventional morality. The leading man is likely to be a drag queen. My guest Pedro Almodovar is best known in America for the comedies Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown and Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, which ended up in court when the distributors challenged its X rating. Almodovar's new movie, High Heels, is about a Spanish pop star so absorbed in her career that she sacrifices her relationship with her daughter. Years after they have become estranged, the daughter marries one of the mother's former lovers. One of the daughter's best friends is a drag queen who does a stirring impression of the mother in his cabaret act. There is a murder, much suffering, and the ultimate maternal sacrifice. The story may remind you of the great melodramas of the 40s and 50s, a genre Almodovar loves, but his melodramas are also comedies that recognize the absurdity of the genre's overblown emotionalism without playing at his camp.
In the Spanish culture, we use generally the humor against everything, and above all against pain and death and so, I mean, all that stuff. So it's... we are very close. I mean, the Spanish culture is very close to tragic comedy. I mean, and also it's related with our life. So I didn't want to avoid the sense of humor in this kind of drama. So this is a drama, but I don't respect the rules of drama. I mean, this is not a drama with victims, and it's not a drama with evil people and very, very, very nice people. I mean, everybody here in this picture, they are bad people or just very imperfect roles. I mean, these kind of women are not a model. But what is important for me is just to explain this complexity and to make them believable and to try to understand them.
Were you really surprised when your film Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down caused such a big controversy in the United States and initially got an X rating?
Yeah, I'm always surprised with that. You know, because when you are making a movie, you never... I mean, it's impossible for me to think like a censor. I mean, I can have the mentality of a censor. So I work with a lot of freedom. So it's a surprise, you know. It was a surprise, and I felt like very misunderstood and a little bit humiliating, because you know in Europe it's very important the freedom of speech, and then when I tried to defend my movie, it wasn't for commercial reason. It was just like a principle that I should defend that right for every author. But I think I was completely misunderstood. It was not a sadomasochistic story. It was a love story. But, you know, sometimes the audience or the people who could be offended project their own problems to the screen and then confuse their problem with what they see. So, you know, the scandal and all that stuff depends more with the eyes that see something than the material itself, which is going to be seen.
What did you find most amusing or most appalling about the whole rating process for Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down?
For me, it was very disgusting, yes, to come to this country, one country that always treated me very well, and to start insulting people and fight against people. You know, I'm a visitor here, I'm a guest. So it's not nice for a guest to behave like that. It was really very uncomfortable, all the proceeds, because, you know, at the end, you are not talking about a movie, you are talking about other things, and this is very complicated. And, you know, then... And everything is confused, because also, I mean, the audience thought that it was really a sexy movie, and when they went to the theater, they were disappointed, because it wasn't that. So, you know, all that stuff gave a bad information to the audience. And also, you know, when I came, I didn't make promotion. I was just fighting all the time.
Did you have to go through a similar process in Spain? Was there a rating system in Spain that you had to submit your movie to?
Well, a long time ago, I mean, 15 years ago, it was much worse than here. It was really a realistic situation with the censorship of Spain. But fortunately, this disappeared after Franco dies. So we don't have nothing like that now. We don't have any kind of censorship now.
You know, I'm wondering, the premise of the rating system is that children can be really hurt by being exposed to certain things. And I wonder if when you were young, you wished that you could be exposed to more than you were.
Absolutely. Anyway, when I was a child, I saw everything. I saw everything, and that was very important for me, for my developing. I mean, I saw many private movies when I was 10 or 11, and it fit me very well.
What kinds of movies did you see that were prohibited?
For example, Inma Berman's El Manantial de la Doncella, The Source of the Virgin. One Inma Verma movie about a girl that was raped. It was very old, and it was a big scandal in Spain.
It's Ingmar Bergman. So.
Inma Bergman.
Oh, Virgin Spring.
Virgin Spring, right.
Okay. Virgin Spring, yeah. That was really outrageous, and it was prohibited, and, well, I saw at 10, and I really love it. And the films like Splendor in the Grass, all that stuff with Tennessee Williams, Heart, Broiled, melodramas, Cat on a Tin Roof. All then were prohibited. And then all of them I saw. Nobody avoided me to go. And I think it was very good for my developments, about my sensibility were growing seeing this movie. So, you know, it's very difficult to know what is good for the children or not. It's very difficult. I'm not sure that Terminator 2 is good, yes, for the boys. It's a very delicate matter.
How did you get to see these prohibited films when you were young?
Well, because I was living in a very small village, well, a small province. And, you know, the doorman didn't mind that, so I came inside.
So they were prohibited?
There was not a big control, a lot of legal control. We are very anarchist, you know, we don't not like here.
So children were prohibited from seeing them, but the movies were screened for adults. Is that?
Yeah.
Did your parents object to you seeing it when you were able to get in?
No, my parents didn't matter at all.
Now, you grew up in La Mancha.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of town was that?
Well, it's a small village, basically agricultora. How you say? I mean, mm-hmm. People working in the country. And it's a very conservative region, one of the most conservative regions in Spain. And perhaps because of that, since the very beginning, I knew exactly what things I have to fight against.
What were those things?
Yeah. Well, the intolerance, the hypocrisy. I mean. A lot of basic things, like the main thing in your life is just your life, you know, because the people living in La Mancha, they are not very generous with themselves. They are working all the time, they don't get that much, and they don't give them any pleasure, and you know, it was exactly the opposite that I felt.
When you said that you had to fight against intolerance, were the people where you grew up intolerant of you?
Well, they look at me as a very strange boy.
What was strange in their eyes about you?
Well, I was not interested in the same things than the others. Since the very beginning, I was interested more in reading, seeing movies, talk about them. And I was not very good in sports, in natural sport. So I don't know. I mean, when I saw them, for me, the strangers were they. But when they look at me, they found me very strange. But I don't know. I mean, because, you know, for me, the rules is myself. I can't. It will be very dangerous for my mind if I look at me and say, oh, my God, I'm a monster. I'm different. No, I'm what I am. I'm regular.
Now, you went to Catholic school, right?
Yeah.
How did you react to the kind of regimentation that often exists in Catholic schools?
Well, the first year I tried to believe that they were right, and I tried to see that God could be a good help to live. But I didn't trust them. I mean, their behavior, it was very opposite to what they were trying to teach us. And also, you know, in a natural way, I refused that education based in the punishment and based in fright, in horror. This is like killing people.
I read somewhere that you were sexually abused by the priests in the Catholic school.
Well, a little bit. I mean, not that much. Yeah, but this is a normal circumstance in the schools, in all the schools with priests and so on. I mean, I was not the only one, and it happens very usually. I mean, I can't say rape it is something like they touch me and then try to push me to touch him and so on. This is an awful experience, I can tell you, but this is very. Unfortunately, it was very normal at the college, from the part of the priest.
Did it frighten you about sex, and did it frighten you about religion?
Of course.
Both?
Of course.
Both,
very much. No, this is an awful experience for a boy.
You left for Madrid, I think, when you were 17.
Yeah, 16 or 17, yeah.
When you moved to the city, how did you change? What were you able to do that you weren't able to do before? How were you able to express yourself in ways that you couldn't before?
I mean, I didn't change. I was like that before going to Madrid. I mean, without knowing, for a question of sensibility, I mean, I feel very strange in my little village, and I felt completely like, well, this is my place in Madrid, and this is something that comes in a very natural way. I mean, you go to a place and you feel well, and you are in another place and you feel really like a prisoner. So I did in Madrid the normal things that a young boy with my interest does. I mean, in that moment, I start knowing people from theater, actors, writers. You know, it was a period where everybody was living like almost in the street, I mean, among the young people. And, you know, for me, it was like the freedom in general. And, I was working because I needed to survive. I was working in the telephone company in the morning, like office assistant or something like that. And in the evening, I started making theater with an independent group. I started writing a lot. I started making Super 8 millimeter movies with a small camera that I bought. And, you know, this kind of things that I suppose that I was born to do it, so it was completely natural for me.
Spanish film director Pedro Almodóvar. His new movie is High Heels. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward surveys this year's box sets. After the short break, this is Fresh Air. During the holiday season, publishers flood the market with coffee table books. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says now the record industry has caught on with deluxe box sets of compact discs featuring retrospectives of everyone from Fats Domino to T-Rex. Ed has been digging his way through the pile, finding that some are invaluable, others are just expensive. Here's the record that started the trend.
I'm gonna get up in the morning. I believe I'll dust my broom. I'm gonna get up in the morning. I believe I'll dust my broom. The black man you've been loving, good friend can get my room.
In 1990, the music business was shocked out of its usual stupor by a very strange hit, a box containing two compact discs featuring every recording made by the legendary Mississippi Delta bluesman Robert Johnson. It sold a whopping 400,000 copies and picked up a gold record and a Grammy along the way. Rather than apply logic to this phenomenon and decide that it was what was in the grooves that sold this huge quantity, the industry decided that it was the fact of CDs in boxes that was important. So this year, we've been deluged by them. A publicist I talked to said that with just the end-of-season releases alone, a reviewer could have covered them all over the course of the 8 days of Hanukkah, doing one the first day, two the next, three the next, and so on. That equals 36 box sets, each a minimum of 2 hours listening time. Leading the way was Atlantic Records, the label that brought rhythm and blues to the American mainstream, made some of the definitive soul records, and then faded in the 70s.
It brings a tear into my eyes when I begin to realize I cried so much since you.
After decades of being only sporadically in print, Ray Charles was finally given a definitive edition of his non-jazz recordings from 1952 to 1959 with a glitzy booklet featuring an essay by Robert Palmer, gorgeous graphics, and swell sound. Earlier in the year, Atlantic released what is probably the best box of discs yet. Nine discs covering the entire output of singles on the Stax and Volt labels between 1958 and 1969, the Stax box, as the folks at your friendly retail outlet know it, goes for about $100 list price, but it's an invaluable document of some of the greatest music this country's ever produced. If the Ray Charles and Stax sets form the core of the soul music story, two sets on other labels form a parenthesis around them. EMI, which now owns United Artists, which itself owns the important R&B labels Aladdin and Imperial, has started a reissue series. And for years, Imperial Records meant one artist in particular. Antoine Domino had his first hit in 1949 and recorded for Imperial through 1960, usually in the company of the incredible Dave Bartholomew Band, which contained the finest musicians in New Orleans at the time. EMI has put together an astonishing package of 100 of Fats Domino's best recordings, entitled They Call Me the Fat Man, with a booklet that's almost as fat as the Fat Man himself, loaded with information, an exemplary piece of work. And Polydor, earlier this year, released another perfect career survey.
Watch me! Watch me! I got it! Watch me!
super bad.
Four super long, super bad discs of James Brown, on which we can hear him evolving from an eccentric blues man to the inventor of funk. Rock and roll, too, has been well served this year. Ever since the CD was invented, people have wondered what Phil Spector's mammoth productions would sound like on them. This year, they found out.
In the land I know, lovers go, flowers grow.
To Mono is a four-disc set, hardly complete, and with a rather uselessly gigantic book, but all remastered by Spector himself, and with plenty of unreleased stuff, including the legendary Ronettes track, Paradise. Britophiles will be happy with Beckology, the Jeff Beck three-disc set. Not only will you hear Rod Stewart back when he was good, but you can hear three recordings by Beck's Beatle-era band, the Tridents. For those nostalgic for the 70s, there's a three-disc collection of T-Rex, as well as another for Aerosmith. And for those who are happy to see the 70s go, there's this.
London's burning! London's burning! All across the town, all across the night, everybody's driving with turn it on your face, a new religion. Everybody's sitting around watching television.
The Clash on Broadway is a mysteriously titled collection of essential tracks by one of the greatest bands of all time, showing their rise and fall brilliantly. There's much more, of course, from Barbra Streisand to four discs of Chicago, which is five more than anybody could want, and a horrifying collection by Yes. There's two multi-disc sets of Bessie Smith, one of Mahalia Jackson that would be perfect if it had her earlier material on it, a box of Howlin' Wolf's Chess recordings, four discs of live Jimi Hendrix, and collections of John Lee Hooker and T-Bone Walker. But I hope the record companies don't get complacent. There's lots more left in the vaults to mine, maybe for next Christmas.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Dan Quayle's Council on Competitiveness. The council was created to reduce the regulatory red tape American businesses have to contend with. But critics say Quayle's council is favoring business at the expense of the environment and is operating beyond the law. We'll talk with New York Times Washington correspondent Philip Hiltz, who has been covering the council. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Bugsy, Warren Beatty's new movie about the gangster who built Las Vegas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Fighting is still going on in Tbilisi, the capital of the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Government and opposition militias around the parliament building traded gunfire all day and continued on after dark. At least 23 people have died, although the TASS news agency said at least 50 are dead. There is no independent confirmation of the claims. Meanwhile, the Georgian president is still considering membership in the new Commonwealth of Independent States. The BBC's Diana Goodman reports from Moscow.
Responding to criticism over Georgia's decision not to join the new Commonwealth of States, Mr. Gamzahordia said he was not opposed to signing up, but some questions needed more study first. Opposition groups in Georgia have been engaged in a struggle with President Gamzahordia since he was elected on a nationalist platform last May. They say that although he's a former dissident, his behavior is undemocratic, for example, when it comes to protecting the rights of ethnic minorities. But the president has repeatedly claimed that a communist mafia is plotting against him to try to oust him from office. Today, opposition leaders again called on the president to resign, and they accused his officials of failing to respond to offers to hold talks.
Diana Goodman reporting. Soviet President Gorbachev and Russian President Yeltsin today discussed the transfer of nuclear weapons from Gorbachev to Yeltsin. The issue of who controls the weapons has been the most pressing since the Central Soviet government collapsed. An aide to Gorbachev said the Soviet leader is expected to make an announcement about his resignation by Wednesday. Over the weekend, 11 of the 12 former Soviet republics proclaimed a new Commonwealth of Independent States. Georgia is the lone holdout. The four nuclear republics, Ukraine, Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan, agreed to let Yeltsin alone keep the briefcase with the codes and communications needed to launch 27,000 Soviet weapons. The decision to launch must be collective. Almost 4 years after he was kidnapped, the remains of Marine Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins will be flown back home to the U.S., NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Higgins was kidnapped in 1988 while serving on a U.N. observation team in Lebanon. A year later, the world saw a horrifying videotape of a man swinging from a noose, a man his kidnappers said was Colonel Higgins. Since the last living U.S. hostage was released earlier this month, President Bush and U.N. officials have been pushing for the return of Higgins' body, as well as that of William Buckley, the other American who died in captivity. Over the weekend, a phone tip led police to a decomposed body in a Beirut street. U.N. officials say medical tests show the body is that of Higgins. But President Bush's spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says final identification will be made once the remains are examined at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. I'm Andy Bowers at the White House.
The Dow gained almost 3% today. The Dow shot up more than 88 points to end the day at 3022.58. Advances swamped declines by a margin of 7-2. This is NPR. Poland finally got a new government today after a two-month struggle. Prime Minister Jan Olszewski had his cabinet approved by parliament by a narrow 17-vote margin. Olszewski backers showed little enthusiasm for his 16 cabinet choices during debate today, but Poland has not had a cabinet since the October 27th elections, and lawmakers apparently did not want the crisis to persist into next year. The government will be the third since the Communist Party gave up power in August 1989. The United Nations is warning of growing famine in the Horn of Africa. Linda Fasulo has more from the United Nations.
According to the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, more than 13 million people face starvation as a result of strife and drought in Sudan and Ethiopia. Of this number, 10 million people are estimated to go hungry because of low crop yields. Sudan's 8-year civil war has displaced nearly 2 million people who need help to ward off famine. And Ethiopia's decades-long civil war, which ended in May, has left over 1 million soldiers and their families in need of food. The head of the UN's food agency has called the situation in Somalia critical. Nearly 5 million people, 60% of Somalia's population, risk starvation. And escalated fighting has disrupted food distribution programs. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
More banks jumped on the prime rate cut bandwagon today, continuing the rate slashing that began last Friday with the Federal Reserve. Among large regional lenders who cut their prime lending rates to 6.5% were Mellon Bank of Pittsburgh, National City Bank of Cleveland, First Fidelity Bank Corporation of Lawrenceville, New Jersey, and M&T Bank of Buffalo. Detroit-based NBD Bancorp cut its prime lending rate to 7%. You're listening to National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Vice President Dan Quayle and his Council on Competitiveness are under scrutiny in Washington. The council was created by President Bush in 1989 to review regulations issued by federal agencies. The council has the power to revise regulations which it decides could harm the competitiveness of American business. It's in the process of undoing or toning down many regulations. If the council gets its way, some of our protected wetlands would be open for development, private companies would be allowed to test drugs for FDA approval, and businesses would have fewer restrictions on releasing pollutants into the environment. Critics have charged that the council is operating in secrecy with powers beyond the law. The council is under investigation by congressional and consumer groups. My guest, Philip Hiltz, has been covering the story for the New York Times. I asked him for an example of how the council operates.
We have the Clean Air Act, which is a major piece of legislation, one of the most important in decades on the environment, that the EPA has been working on for a couple of years, trying to refine the proposals. How do you give a permit to a company that is going to pollute? To what degree will they be allowed? How much would it cost? When can you cut back pollution and so on? The EPA works through this, takes comments from industry, from environmentalists, from everybody, works out a regulation, writes it down, puts it out for public comment. Then it comes back after they read the public comments, they put it out finally. But now they've inserted the Council on Competitiveness right after that process. So that the White House can take another look after everybody's agreed and say, well, now there are a couple things in here that are really too expensive. For example, municipal waste. There was a rule in which you'd have to have a permit before you start an incinerator in your town and burn up your trash. EPA would give you a permit. But the rule was going to be, in order to get a permit, first you'd have to agree to recycle 25% of your trash. Then they'd let you burn the rest. The Council on Competitiveness came in and said, well, I don't think we like that. We'll just cut that one out. And we'll, if they want to, fine, we'll make it voluntary.
You're describing the situation where after the regulatory agency comes up with the regulations, puts it open to public hearings, revises the regulations, then the council has the right to come in and either further revise them or throw them out. Does the regulatory agency have any power to say, no, we refuse?
Well, this is an old issue that goes all the way back to the beginning, to the way the Constitution was written. The view of it in the courts and in the agencies for the last 100 years, say, is that the federal agencies are to interpret the laws passed by Congress. Now, the federal agencies are created by Congress. They're funded by Congress. So they're really agencies of Congress in a way. They carry out the Congress's will. But the president, under the Constitution, puts a check on that. These agencies which carry out the Congress's will are in the executive branch, and the president supervises them. So the belief is that the agency head is the one who should make the final decision. And then the president and his policies come into it in a kind of supervisory way. They say, the president says to the agency head, okay, you do these regulations, but I want you to do them according to my policy. I want you to pass you some changes. I want to make sure that you're sticking to our game plan. Otherwise, of course, I can fire you. So it's this tension between both sides. In theory, if an agency head said to the president, I'm simply not going to go along with you, he could probably maintain that position legally. He could probably get by in court. But in practice, it's very difficult for him to do that.
Critics of the vice president's Council on Competitiveness have said that the president is really being a hypocrite in this area. On the one hand, for instance, last year he signs the Clean Air Act and wants to take credit for being the environmental president. And then, meanwhile, the Council on Competitiveness completely tries to completely revise the act.
And he put in place William Riley at the head of EPA, who is a pretty active environmental guy. And so he's got things going in both directions, which I think is the way he wants it. The idea is the Clean Air Act is a really major piece of legislation, something that is a rational approach to handling the air and to handling pollution. On the other hand, he needs to be seen for his constituency to be anti-regulatory, to be anti-bureaucratic. And in this case, the vehicle is Dan Quayle. They want Dan Quayle to be out there being the spokesman of the right, being in a visible position like he never was, giving him some sway. So they handed him this job. You go police the regulatory agencies. So it is kind of goes two ways, but I think that's the way they want it.
Well, what impact do you think this has had on the image of Vice President Dan Quayle? His image has been that of the, well, he's always been the butt of the joke and considered a real lightweight.
Yeah, well, this is for him almost all gain because he gets to be in the position of making substantial changes in very important regulations. Before, of course, he was getting all this criticism. Now he's in a position where he gets the criticism, but they're quite serious. It's no longer a laughing matter. The chairmen all over the Hill are getting very upset and are passing bills, holding hearings, trying to deal with this competitiveness council, which they consider an outlaw. And Quayle is really enjoying the new visibility and the new influence that comes with this job of overseeing regulations and driving the environmentalists and the people on the Hill crazy.
Congressman Henry Waxman, who chairs the House Subcommittee on Health and the Environment, has said that Vice President Quayle is running the council like a shadow government. I think part of the reason why Waxman made that criticism is because Quayle has given the council executive privilege, and the council has not been handing over information about itself, and representatives haven't been showing up when invited to attend hearings.
Yeah, the theory here is that the Council on Competitiveness is in the vice president's office, which is part of the executive office of the president. And the rule, according to the court so far, has been that in the executive office of the president, there may be deliberations that people in the branch may take positions, may argue positions completely secretly, so that it's possible to have an open discussion without fearing public reprisals. This is called the executive privilege. But then there's the question of this council, which is several removes from the president. And suppose it's not so much a matter of internal arguments over policy in the executive branch. Suppose it's a matter of actually changing regulations, acting as a regulatory agency. There was a decision in the, I think, Court of Appeals in the district recently that said the predecessor to the Council on Competitiveness was acting as an agency. If it looks like an agency, acts like an agency, carries out policy, changes policy, it is an agency. So that it may have executive privilege when it goes talk to the president, but when it's dealing with the agencies, it's an agency. So it's kind of this funny thing in between the two. And what in Congress they've said is, well, if you're going to have this agency doing all these things, this council operating this way, we ought to see who they're dealing with. list the people who come in to talk to them, what industries are coming in, list the positions of the people coming in. If they come in with a proposal saying, let's change this and this, let's have it on paper so we can see it and argue with it.
So right now there's really no accountability?
No. They feel that this is really something that is their own prerogative. It has a kind of funny history, though, because the Office on Management and Budget in the White House, when Reagan first came in, did exactly the same sort of thing. They were reviewing regulations. They had secrecy in the beginning. But after fights with Congress over a few years, by about 1985 or 86, they said, okay, we agree. These things should be open. They set up all kinds of new procedures so that people calling in cannot call anybody on the staff. They can call only a certain person. When they call in, it has to be recorded. The proposals come in. They have to be put on a docket. They agreed to all of that. But just after agreeing to that, then the council comes up again, a new agency, again secrecy, and so on. So the people in Congress feel like they've been around this once before.
If you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times reporter Philip Hiltz, and he's been covering the story of the Vice President's Council on Competitiveness. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. New York Times reporter Philip Hiltz is my guest. He's been covering the story of Vice President Quayle's Council on Competitiveness. There's also the question of conflict of interest. There's a conflict of interest regulation in federal government that bars any official in the executive government from participating in any matter in which he has a financial interest. And the executive director of the council, Alan Hubbard, half owns a chemical company and has a fairly large stock holding in a power company.
Yeah, PSI.
In Indiana, yeah, Public Service Company of Indiana. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So now Vice President Quayle has given him a waiver of conflict mm-hmm. of interest.
This is all very complicated because the shape of the conflict of interest rules is kind of vague, and it depends on who you ask. But in this case, what they've done is given him a waiver, given Hubbard a waiver. The vice president gave him the waiver, saying, you don't have to worry about these things, and if there is a problem, you can recuse yourself, take yourself out of a decision officially. But the view outside the White House is that this is quite illegal, that the idea of a waiver is completely contrary to the idea of a conflict of interest law. If you can waive the law, what's the point of it? If you can go in and have these dealings and not worry about them, why bother having a conflict of interest law in the first place?
So where does Alan Hubbard stand now with the conflict of interest regulation?
After the issue was raised, he decided that he should put all his holdings in a blind trust and give away the PSI stock to charity. The blind trust is a situation where he puts all his stock holdings and bonds and so on in the hands of a manager, and the manager handles it, doesn't ever tell him what's going on. So essentially he loses control of all his interests, but he doesn't lose the money. So it's still there. He has some sense of what it is. It's kind of a halfway step toward divesting yourself.
What about the vice president's financial interest? Does he have any financial interest that would pose a conflict of interest question about him?
Sure. Yeah, he's a businessman from Indiana as well. His are mostly in newspapers and pulp companies and so on. He has, it's unclear, but at least $350,000 in that. And he has not given himself a waiver, and he has not gone to a blind trust as Vice President Bush did when he was in the same sort of position at the top of one of these agencies. So the sense in Congress is, well, he's not even operating by the kind of standards that Mr. Bush has operated by or Mr. Reagan operated by. He is, again, a kind of an outlaw. Why doesn't he divest himself? Why doesn't he stand back from those things so he can go ahead and get himself involved in these regulations without looking like he's on one side. The whole idea in conflict of interest academically is an interesting one because the basis of it is supposed to be that the people are permitted confidence in their leaders. They should not have to worry about whether there is a financial interest, whether this might actually affect somebody's judgment. The law is built all around the idea that if it appears that there could be something nefarious going on, then that is a conflict, and you should step back from it.
You mentioned that the vice president owns about $350,000 in a newspaper company, and the conflict there, I think, would center around recycling.
Yes.
Or one of the conflicts, anyways, potential conflicts of interest.
Yeah, there are others, but recycling was one of the first rules that the Competitiveness Council dealt with, and this is the one we mentioned before, municipal waste. If you want to burn waste in your municipality, you have to go to EPA to get a permit, and the permit they will give to you only, this was the proposal, only if you're willing to recycle 25% at least in the beginning. And what Mr. Quayle stepped in and did was strip that out. He didn't like the idea of 25% recycling. He wanted it to be voluntary rather than mandatory, and he succeeded in that.
And perhaps we should mention that the company that he owns stock in uses virgin paper, not recycled paper.
Yeah, so that in theory would make it a competition between his company and the recycling companies, and he has taken a position which you could interpret as being on the side of the virgin paper companies against the recyclers.
You are one of the reporters covering this story and making the public aware of what the controversy is surrounding the council. There are several bodies that are investigating the council. Do you know how the administration is reacting to the press coverage and to the current investigations of the council?
Well, they love it. The idea of the visibility and getting this message out that they're being tough is what they really love. They complain, of course, about the way in which sentences are written and the way things are twisted around and so on. The point of view of the Congress that this all ought to be open at the White House. So they say, well, why shouldn't the deliberations in Congress be open? Why don't we see the staff in Congress, see who's going to visit them, the way they're trying to get us to say who's visiting us? So they complain about those things, but in general, they're just tremendously happy with it.
Even though a lot of the press coverage has been very critical of
it
the council.
It seems that way, but you have to remember what their mission is. They really are glad to be seen as feisty outsiders, people attacking federal government, people trying to preserve the rights and the privacy and the independence of businesses. This is what they've been doing.
Philip Hiltz, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Philip Hiltz is Washington correspondent for The New York Times. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel, host of NPR's All Things Considered. Coming up later on today's program, we'll be hearing about the news in Moscow, where a resignation by Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev is expected within the next couple of days. Also, reports on the transfer of the Soviet Union's nuclear codes from Gorbachev to Russian President Boris Yeltsin, and fighting in Georgia, one of the Soviet republics, or former Soviet republics, that has not joined in the new Commonwealth. Also, we'll be hearing a bit of revisionist history about the Neanderthals and the cut of welfare payments in the state of Michigan. There's no more general assistance there. We'll hear why and what the effect of that cut has been. Coming up today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Some people think of Warren Beatty as the man who made Bonnie and Clyde, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and Shampoo three of the best films of the 60s and 70s. To others, he's the guy who made Ishtar and Dick Tracy and has had all those love affairs. Film critic Stephen Schiff thinks that from now on, everybody's going to think of Warren Beatty as the man who made Bugsy.
I had my doubts. For one thing, I didn't think Warren Beatty, shy, fumbling, distracted Warren Beatty, could play the vicious side of the gangster Ben, don't call him Bugsy Siegel. I knew he could play the side that was all narcissism and charm, the side that blew into Hollywood in the 40s and partied with movie stars, half believing that he was a movie star himself. I knew he could play Ben Siegel, the man with a dream, who took a desolate desert town called Las Vegas and turned it into, well, Las Vegas. But I didn't know that he could scare you. I doubted that he could make you believe in Siegel's crazy temper and cruelty. I was wrong. This is Beatty's best performance since Shampoo in 1975, and maybe his best ever. And that's partly because he manages to convince you of both the vanity and the viciousness. In fact, he shows you how the one develops from the other. Siegel's fatuous self-love impels him to force his will on everybody around him. And then, when he falls in love with the starlet Virginia Hill, beautifully played by his real-life love Annette Bening, she becomes an extension of his self-intoxication. He forces her on everyone around him, too. All of which may sound a little too weighty for a gangster flick, but it doesn't play that way. Bugsy is wildly funny and entertaining, and that's partly because of the sassy, energetic screenplay by James Toback, which mixes equal parts humor, sex, and dread to make the fizziest cocktail the movies have offered in ages. Take, for instance, the scene in which Siegel first lays eyes on Virginia Hill. He's been whisked off to a movie set by his boyhood pal, the actor George Raft, played by Joe Mantegna, and he can't keep his eyes off Hill. He strides over to her, and noticing her cigarette is unlit, pops a question.
May I?
If you want a simple yes or no, you're going to have to finish the question.
Light your cigarette.
Sure. The way you were staring at me, I thought you were going to ask me for something a little more exciting.
Like what?
Use your imagination.
I'm using it.
Let me know when you're finished.
Toback and the director Barry Levinson clearly adore Siegel and his world. The 40s Hollywood they've created has a rich, romantic sheen. And the movie romanticizes Siegel, too. In the filmmaker's eyes, he's a warped version of the American dream, a hustler trying to realize a vision. True, his vision of a golden city of money in the Nevada desert turns out to be tawdry Vegas. And his vision of ideal love centers on a faithless showgirl who's been around the block a few times. But Beatty Siegel views himself the way Hollywood movie makers often view themselves, as a visionary having to battle the talentless money men, knowing that if he doesn't believe, no one will. All of which makes for an enthralling version of the gangster myth. But it has its drawbacks, too. By the end of the movie, when the closing titles seem to be representing Las Vegas as a triumph of the human spirit, you can't help thinking the filmmakers have gone a little soft in the head. Still, they've done almost everything else right. Bugsy is the sort of sprawling, vital American movie you remember from the golden age of the early 70s, when pictures like The Godfather and Taxi Driver and Mean Streets and Chinatown made you believe that the movies could open up rich new worlds. Bugsy does that, too. It makes you believe in movies again.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Ron Barron, and Audrey Voblaitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the chair, we talk with a great singer. Tony Bennett looks back with us on his 40 years in the business. And we'll get to hear his version of White Christmas, one of the best. Also, we talk with comedian Nora Dunn. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.